5 years ago, before I started working on this book, I was an ordinary person such as yourselves. I didn't know nothing about no radiation. Radiation connoted to me something scary and dangerous and frightening, and I thought it was contaminating. I thought you got cancer the minute you looked at it, and so that's what it connoted to me. But the denotation of radiance is something quite different. It's little chubby fat atoms. It's atoms that are so obese that they violate the laws of attraction that create matter and spit out little pieces of themselves. They spit out two kinds of particles and a little wave of energy called a gamma ray, which is sort of like a super X-ray and is composed of photons, which is my favorite subatomic particle, the photon. Now, later at the Q&A, we're going to ask you what is your favorite subatomic particle, and you will have to defend why yours is superior to the photon. So I hope you'll be ready for that. Anyway, so it's these little fat atoms, and aren't they cute? They're very cute, huh? There's a fat little uranium, and here's what it actually looks like. So you can think of radioactive elements as being the Hollywood starlets of the periodic table. They're bulimic and unstable. And like Hollywood starlets, they can be charming, you know. When Marie Curie left her lab, she left her radium up on the walls. So she'd come home in the mornings before daybreak, and her walls would be glowing with the radium. But then someone noticed when she put away the radium, the walls were still glowing. And someone talked about when they first got plutonium out of a reactor, Enrico Fermi's plutonium. You would take this silvery metal, and it was warm like a puppy, right? But at Los Alamos, if you held the puppy in your arms for too long, the solution was something called high amputation. So I hope you're seeing the theme for this evening: denotation, connotation, and a sort of adorable horror movie kind of a thing we're going to do, okay? So I hope you're ready for that. Okay, now, I know that some of you are sitting here saying to yourselves, when is he going to get to the fundamental concept of modern physics that unites quantum mechanics with classical physics and explains the subatomic duality of particle and wave? So, okay, we'll do that right now, all right? Okay? Let's get this over with, we'll get it out of the way, and then we'll get to the women, okay? All right, so let's say you're on a plane and you look out the window and you see a bunch of dots. And since you are a world-class physicist, you take out your slide rule and you start making a mathematical picture of these dots, how they appear, how they disappear, the rate that they're moving, the size, all these kinds of things. You then take out your binoculars and you see that these dots are white caps. And you know that underlying the white caps are waves. And you know wave mechanics. Now, in the universe, there is a music. And there isn't very much melody, but there's lots of rhythm. And that rhythm is wave mechanics, which is a whole subset of mathematics. And because of your binoculars and because of your knowledge, you've now created a whole different set of mathematics based on the waves. And this is how it has nothing to do with Hindu mystical religion. This is how something in the subatomic world can be in sometimes a particle, a piece of mass, like a white cap, and sometimes a wave, a piece of energy, depending on the instruments we use and the mathematics we use to create that picture. So I'm glad we got that over with, thank God. Okay, right. Now, leaving our prefatory remarks, I want to say to you, when you grew up, you were taught the denotation of history. You had to learn epochs. You had to learn when great men and women were born and died. You had to learn dates of battles, and you memorized all this stuff. But the father of history says, that's not what history is about. This is a Greek guy named Herodotus. He says history is about one thing, and that is, have I got a story for you? Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Manya, who was the youngest of five children of a family that had once been quite prosperous, but had fallen on hard times. And when Manya turned 17, her elder sister Branya said, let's make a deal. You go to work for 2 years and support me while I go to school, and then I'll turn around and do the same thing for you. And this was quite a nervy idea to come up with at the time, since at that moment, it was illegal for women past the age of 12 to get an education. And Branya and Manya were getting around that by attending something called the Floating University, which floated so that the authorities couldn't track down who was running it and throw them in a labor camp. All right? The floating university did a very good job. Bronya got into medical school at the Sorbonne, the University of Paris, and off she goes. And off Manya goes to become a nanny. All right? Now, she's slaving away. First, she works for a bunch of lawyers, and she does not have a good time. And she has many wonderful, vicious things to say about these lawyers. But then she works for this family that runs a sugar beet plantation about 60 kilometers outside Warsaw, and it is fantastic. She loves them. They let her teach the peasants how to read and write, which was also illegal at this time. The whole family loves her. They're the Zarovskis. It's a great job. And then the oldest Zarovsky son, Kazimir, comes home from college, and he and Manya fall head over heels in love. And for 1 year, they're dating, and at the end of it, he says, I'm going to tell my parents we're getting married. And he goes and tells the parents, and all the kids know about this, and they're all excited, and they all think this is just great. Manya and Kazimir are going to be so happy together. And the parents say, are you out of your mind? You're marrying someone better than us, not someone worse than us. You're not marrying this penniless nobody. Forget it. And Manya is just crushed, and Kazimir says, just wait, I'll talk them into it. I know I can do it. And for 6 months, they date each other secretly, and then the parents find out about it and fire her. She goes back to live with her father. She's devastated. She's now 19, and she's heartbroken, and she doesn't know what to do, and the letter comes from the sister. I'm engaged to be married. I finished medical school. Now it's your time. Come to Paris. And she can't do it. She's so in love with Kazimir, she just can't go to Paris. And finally, the letter from Kazimir arrives saying, forget it, we're never getting married. My parents are never going to allow it. It's never going to happen. Forget it. Years later, Kazimir would grow up to become a famous mathematician in Warsaw, Poland. And he would be frequently seen in the main square of Poland gazing up at the Titanic statue of the national hero of Poland, Marie Curie, which is who Manya grew up to be. Now, you all know Marie and Pierre. They have this great love affair. They work together. They discover, really, radioactivity. They give it its name. They discover two elements. They discover it can be used against cancerous tumors. They really revolutionize science. And they're a great couple. But Marie has two boyfriends before and after Pierre. And you look at these and you think, what if in the space-time continuum something a little different had happened? What if she had followed her heart and stayed with Kazimir? But the second story is even better. And this is after Pierre dies, Marie has an incredible affair with one of her students, who is this dapper young man who's so famous. He's sitting to the right of Einstein. This is Paul. And she and Paul have an incredible affair. They rent a house that's just for them to have their affair in. They call it Chez Nous. They write these passionate letters back and forth. Paul is also a genius in physics. They just get along like nobody's business. But there's a problem. Paul's married. The wife doesn't care that he has a mistress. She does care that it's the most famous woman in France. And she has a brother who runs a tabloid newspaper. And they launch such a campaign against Marie that it becomes a worldwide scandal, so that when she goes to Copenhagen to get her second, to Sweden to get her second Nobel Prize, they say, maybe you could come next year. Maybe you don't need to come right now. And Einstein basically says, fuck him, go get the prize. But anyway, so it's this horrible scandal, and again she's brokenhearted, but Paul tells Marie, you know, I've got this real go-getter working for me. His name is Fred, and you should hire him to work in your lab. And she meets Fred, and Fred says, and really impresses her, and she hires him. And after a year, Fred comes to Marie and says, I want to marry your daughter, Irene. And Marie says, hell no. Just like Kazimir's parents, she doesn't want Irene leaving her house. She doesn't want her marrying this guy. All this kind of stuff, she just can't do it. And finally, she agrees to do it, but she makes Fred sign one of the first prenups in history, that if anything happens in the marriage, all of the radium is going to stay with the Curie family. But Marie was wrong. Fred and Iran become so important that they are really more important to us today than Marie and Pierre, because Fred and Iran discover artificial radioactivity, which is the foundation of nuclear medicine and is important today as the microscope. And because of this long story I've told you, Marie Curie was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, and her own daughter, Iran, was the second. Now, because of Fred and Iran's discovery, everyone all over the world starts irradiating everything they can. They're just going crazy. And one guy who's really doing it is this villainous chemist named Otto Hahn, who's working in Berlin. And Otto's partner was a woman named Lisa Meitner. And you've never heard of her because she was written out of history twice. First, she was written out of history for being Jewish, and then she was written out for being a woman, but the physicist community took vengeance for this. Let me tell you that story. So Lisa Meitner is the second woman in the 500-year history of the University of Vienna to get an advanced degree. She is the first woman to be a university professor in Germany, and she runs the physics department of the most important research institution in the world, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, for a dozen years. For various details I won't go into, she gets out of Germany at the last possible minute. And she ends up, through Niels Bohr's inner help, working in Sweden. But where she's working, the guy sees her as her boss thinks she's competition. He doesn't have the equipment she needs. And she's left behind her entire life's work back in Berlin. She's now 60 years old. It's Christmas Eve, 1938. She's all washed up, and she's completely forlorn, and she really is at scraping the bottom of the barrel. And her nephew, Otto Robert Frisch, who is the Zelig of our history tonight, so let's remember his name, Otto Robert Frisch. The nephew comes to visit her on Christmas. And for Christmas, of course, they have that fantastic Scandinavian dish, lutefisk. Has anyone here eaten lutefisk? Yes. It is the worst thing I have ever put in my mouth, and I've eaten tarantula legs, okay? Lutefisk is sort of like beef jerky that you buy at the 7-Eleven, except it's made out of fish and it has the consistency of Jell-O. I can't, before you die, you should try it. So this is what they have for Christmas, right? And then they go off for a walk in the woods, and Lisa is obsessed with this thing that she's hearing back from the, who she doesn't know yet, is villainous Otto Hahn, that they keep trying to artificially radiate uranium and they keep getting barium. And this doesn't make sense, because normally when you irradiate something, you make a little isotope of it right next to it on the periodic table. So you get one over here, one over there. But barium is way down at the bottom. It's really far down from the periodic table, from the uranium. So they think the chemistry is wrong. They think their instruments are wrong. They think something is screwing this up. And Lisa goes and sits on a snow, in a snow-covered log on Christmas. And she takes out a piece of paper and a pencil. And she draws Niels Bohr's water drop idea of the atom. At this point, there are many ideas of what the atom was because, of course, no one had ever seen one. And some people had come up with the plum pudding model of the atom, which, like plum pudding, is not as good as it sounds. And other people had come up with the planetary circle of the atom. And Niels Bohr had come up with this blurry thing of the atom that we can't really conceptualize because nothing ever sits still long enough for us to think about it. Anyway, but he had come up with this water droplet model saying that, well, maybe even though we think of matter as this really solid thing, maybe deep down inside, it's not what we think. So she draws this little water drop model, and she takes out the numbers of what would happen if you cut it in half. Then she figures out how much energy would be released, and she takes what is left over, and she applies E equals MC2, and it all fits. And Otto Robert goes back to Niels Bohr's lab where he's working, and next door is a biologist, and he goes, what do they call it when the molecules split, a bacterium split in two? And the biologist says, that's called fission. So this is what Lisa Meitner discovers, fission. And people are so excited about this that it upends. Niels Bohr goes to visit Einstein at Princeton. And instead of talking about their competing theories of the universe, all they talk about is fission. And it's the only thing anyone can think about, because if it's true, it would mean that you could figure out a way to release the energy within matter, which could lead to an incredible source of power and, of course, an enormous explosive device. And what everyone is thinking about is, what if Adolf Hitler had this explosive device? So what Otto Hahn does is he continues working on this and takes credit for all of it. And after the war is over, he becomes the shining example of German might, and plus Meitner's boss, Schreuser. So he gets the Nobel Prize for discovering fission, not Lisa Meitner. But then years later, the physicist arranged so that he and Meitner are nominated to be a element on the periodic table. And they bring in the results, and Meitner wins, and Hahn doesn't. So there will always be a Meitnerium, but there will never be a Hahnium because of the rules of getting on the periodic table. So that was the revenge they took. Now, so this huge explosion happens with the fission, and everyone is now trying to blow up, split the atom, and they're doing it all over the place. And this all leads to what I call the third most dangerous experiment in the history of American science, where a guy named Enrico Fermi, who the only reason we know any details about Fermi's personal life, by the way, is because his somewhat Lucille Ball-esque wife, Laura, wrote a fantastic autobiography called Atoms of the Family. And Laura Fermi is so marvelous because the whole reason Fermi comes to America is because Laura is Jewish, and she admits in this book that she fought him every inch of the way coming over here. That why we don't have to go, there's no reason, this is a passing fancy, everything's gonna be fine, I don't wanna leave Rome. She didn't care for America because she was upset that when she went to University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, that it was the Prohibition era. So they had to bury the alcohol in the lab so that people wouldn't dig it up and drink it. And she found that upsetting. And then because she had such an Italian accent, every time she tried to buy something on the phone, something else would show up. So she had a terrible time in America. She didn't like it. But she was, her husband insisted that immediately after winning the Nobel Prize, they come over here and become refugees. And her father went to Auschwitz. So he was right. So Fermi's great moment. And all subatomic particles that are composed of mass are fermions. So this is how great this guy is. Okay, so Enrico Fermi is here in the middle. Actually, he's bending over. And this is the first nuclear reactor. And it was supposed to be built in the Argonne Forest in the middle of the woods, but there was a strike by the construction company doing it. So they built it in the middle of Chicago. The University of Chicago had stopped having a football team, and it had an abandoned stadium, and inside this abandoned stadium was an abandoned squash court, and this is where the first nuclear reactor was built in the United States. And it seems to me that many things might have not gone well with this experiment, but in fact it went perfectly. And what they are doing is they've created this giant lattice of graphite and uranium, it's called by the scientific name the pile. And in fact, they still call nuclear reactor managers pile drivers. And in my book, you will see excruciating, nail-biting details about this experiment, which we have because there was one woman at this experiment, Fermi's graduate student, Leona Woods, and she took incredible notes, including the note that Fermi said, "You know, it always amazes me when I think of how humble I am." So so here we have this. They're pulling out rods that stop the nuclear reaction from happening, and he knows exactly how many rods it's going to take and exactly at what time it's going to happen, and he shows everyone on the graph and with a stopwatch, item for item, and it happens perfectly like that. And it's considered the most perfect scientific experiment in America, but there's a fantastic little postscript. The Soviet spies sending information back to Moscow about all this, had a little confusion with the translation. So when they sent back that it was in a squash court, for almost 30 years, the Soviets thought the first American nuclear reactor was built in a pumpkin patch. We'll now move a little bit ahead in this story because to tell you about a woman named Catherine Page. Catherine, at a very young age, was told that she did not have long to live. So she decided to marry a man named Winthrop Page, who is 30 years older than her, and move to the family's farm out in New Mexico and live there. But in fact, Catherine did not die of a young age, and her father never came out west, and she sort of ran this version of a spa in the 1930s in New Mexico. And one day, this very frail little Jewish boy from New York showed up there, and he was coughing and coughing, and the doctor said, maybe it's TB, maybe you should go out to Arizona, not it's your chain smoking. But anyway, he goes out to Arizona, and he falls in love with it. And Catherine shows him around, and she teaches him how to ride horseback. And he brings out his brother. His name is Bob. He brings out his brother, Frank. And the two of them go off together, and they ride all the way on horseback, all the way from New Mexico to Colorado. And it's sort of this great story of the love of the American West, because all they have is their horseback and their chocolate-covered raisins and their whiskey and their sausage. So there's a great story in here for all of us. Women, if guys are not giving you the attention you deserve, history recommends you try horseback riding, chocolate-covered raisins, and whiskey. Then, anyway, one day, Catherine took the two boys up to this peak, and it was this cabin in the middle of nowhere in this beautiful pines, and the Robert said, oh, my God, this is so beautiful. Hot dog, I love it. And she said, no, not hot dog, pero caliente. So that's what he named his home. And right outside the home was a little area, a little sort of valley. And in this valley was a stream. And next to the stream were cottonwood trees. And cottonwood is very important in the Southwest because it grows very fast. It's not very good for fire, but it's very good for timber. And the name for cottonwood in Spanish is the cottonwoods is Los Alamos. So Bob became, of course, Robert Oppenheimer. And he wrote to a friend, if only I could figure out how to combine physics and New Mexico. And one of the ways he was able to do this was by realizing that Leslie Groves, the man who had built the Pentagon building and was now going to build the entire Manhattan Project, loved security. So he brought him to this town where there was one road and one telephone wire. And Leslie Groves said, this is perfect. And that's how Los Alamos was created where it was. Okay, so now we're going to look at, I need you to pay close attention to these next two pictures back to back. This is the Hiroshima bomb. The Hiroshima bomb was so basic and so easy. It's basically a gun inside of a bomb. When it detonates by hitting those knobs at the end, a plug of uranium is going to be thrown into a dish of uranium. And the design was so simple that it was never tested before it was dropped on Hiroshima. And it's so simple that the plans were burned up afterward so that foreign governments wouldn't get their hands on it. But to find out how much uranium you needed your plug in your dish, the second most dangerous experiment in the history of science was conducted by Otto Robert Frisch, our nephew. So here we go. So Otto Robert goes off in the middle of the canyons, and he creates this thing like a guillotine. And he has he has different sizes of the uranium isotope that they're going to put in the bomb, and he's able to adjust the size of the dish and of the clock. And so it's going through this, and as it drops through these rings, you have super criticality for a fraction of a second. So physicist Freeman Dyson said, we called it tickling the dragon's tail because we were trying to come as close as possible to an explosion without actually blowing ourselves up. Remember this bomb, because this is the Nagasaki bomb. Now, the other bomb was a uranium isotope bomb. This is a plutonium bomb. The reason why they're making these two different bombs is because the great secret of American atomic history is that it's very difficult making the materials that go inside the bombs. It's very easy to make the physical engineering bombs themselves, and very difficult. So they only have this tiny amount of uranium isotope and this tiny amount of plutonium. And the whole reason we only dropped two bombs at the end of World War II is because we only had two bombs. All right, so this is the bomb that will be detonated as Trinity. And all these wires are because they're doing this wild thing. They're going to take a ball, two halves of a ball of plutonium that's about the size of an orange, and they're going to set up all these explosions around it to compress it so that it's the size of a big marble. And the idea came for this came from Seth Niedermeyer, a student, a Caltech student of Oppenheimer's. But everyone said he was wrong, except for my favorite Hungarian nuclear scientist, Johnny von Neumann. Now, Johnny von Neumann came up with the mathematics to prove that this would all work. He was such a natty dresser that he went mule riding in the Grand Canyon in a three-piece pinstripe suit. He invented the modern computer that uses binary for both programs and data. And his wife, Clara von Neumann, programmed that modern computer. Clara said, Johnny is such a good mathematician, he can count everything except calories. And Johnny became very famous for a special corner. He also worked at Princeton. They have a corner at Princeton called the von Neumann Corner, and it's named that because he really liked to drive his car and read a book at the same time, and he crashed so often into this corner that that's how he's remembered now at Princeton. So the three ways of making, the four ways of making things that go inside of bombs were all done here at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. There was the nuclear reactor version of which we saw already. There was the cyclotron. And if any of you have seen the wonderful movie Particle Fever, the descendants of the cyclotron are in that. It's on Netflix. It's all about the finding of the Higgs boson. I recommend it entirely, although the people in that movie aren't as Asperger's-y as the people here. But anyway, so you'll get sort of an idea. Just think of them as being very difficult to eat dinner with to get a better picture. Anyway, so they have cyclotrons. And the cyclotrons are very interesting because basically they're proton racetracks. And the electricity coming into Oak Ridge is very erratic, and the people running the cyclotrons had to use these dials to stabilize the electricity. And the people hired to do this were high school dropout women from the neighboring areas. And so they were doing this, and a bunch of scientists from Los Alamos showed up, and they said, these women are just not doing it as well as we could. So the two of them have a contest to see who can do it better. Who win? The woman. Now, the one thing about learning this history is that you have to expect that there are things in the world that are what we like and are not what we like. And one of the things that aren't what we like is, gee, I wish we could still watch atomic explosions because damn, they're pretty. So now we're going to watch 13 of them together, and we're going to do it with the countdown, which was invented at the first nuclear explosion in Trinity, okay? 13, 12, 11. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, whoop, whoop, oh my goodness, what happened to the other ones? Rats. Well, at least now we've arrived at the most dangerous experiment in the history of science, which is that a long time ago in 1939, Enrico Fermi was having lunch with one of his protégés, another Hungarian nuclear scientist, but not my favorite, not Johnny von Neumann. This man was named Edward Teller, and he's sort of the Iago of our story. Anyway, so Enrico Fermi has lunch with Ed Teller, and he goes, you know, Ed, I don't understand why. The Americans are working on fission, but you know, if we have fission and we create this much heat, that could fuse hydrogen and create fusion, which would be much more powerful and a much better bomb to make. And Edward Teller became so obsessed with this that he refused to do the work he was supposed to do at Los Alamos, and he basically threw Oppenheimer over the bridge at the security clearance hearings and sort of became this dreadful person because all he wanted to do was create fusion. And here is the first test of fusion, which happens at the Bikini Atoll. The Bikini is introduced at this time because, like the atomic bomb, the Bikini is small and devastating. This is a test called Mike. And Mike was supposed to be about four times the size of Hiroshima, and instead it was 800 times the size of Hiroshima. And one of the scientists looking at it said, "We started having the snow fall on us," meaning radioactive fallout, "and we probably got about 12 rads from that, but I couldn't stop looking at it. It looked like the diseased brain of a madman with pieces of the brain folding in and of itself." It wasn't just another puny atomic bomb. And the thing about Mike that's really astonishing is that it had such a tremendous force that it contaminated a Japanese tuna boat, the Lucky Dragon. And the Lucky Dragon returned to port, and one of the fishermen died, and no one knew why all of their hair was falling out, and all of this contaminated tuna was sold into the Japanese market. So the Japanese felt that for the third time, the Americans had attacked them with a nuclear device. And right after that happened, a movie called Godzilla came out. And while all of us who watched Godzilla thought it was funny, because I think Godzilla was like made out of rubber and a sock puppet, or so it was the most basic special effects ever, the Japanese had a very mythic feeling for it, because Godzilla was both the monster attacking them and the disfigured atomic creatures they were turning into. And many Japanese could not watch that movie. They would burst into tears and run out of the theater. And at the same time as this is happening, some biologists are working with fruit flies, and they irradiate the fruit flies and produce a series of generations and come up with these extraordinary genetic mutations. And the combination of that, Godzilla, the fruit flies, creates the entire Marvel universe of Spider-Man with his radioactive spider and the giant ants and all of this. And I feel like almost everything about that we think about the term nuclear and fission and radioactivity all stems from this moment in history, the creation of the them ants and Godzilla and all of these kinds of creatures. Now, I know a number of you are Zen Buddhists in the audience, and you are thinking, in a talk of such perfection, why isn't he introduced an error to show his humility in the face of the universe? So for you Zen Buddhists, here is a slide out of order to help you feel better, okay? Now, when I do my talk, people say, "What about dirty bombs? Shouldn't we be afraid of dirty bombs?" And I go, "Well, you know, the worst terrorist attack in American history was done with box cutters and flying lessons." So I don't know if nuclear physics is the next step in that. However, there is something to be nervous about, and that is the fact that because we don't have a storage facility for long-term nuclear waste, they're stored in open swimming pool-like tanks at 12 points all over the United States, and then we have this giant transportation network of nuclear things. These are where nuclear weapons are, where they're made, where the power plants are, and where all the components go. So you can see a lot of the continental United States has little things. So if you want to be frightened about something, I think this is a good thing to pick. Now, one of the most fantastic things in my research was finding out that Stanley Kubrick's fantastic Dr. Strangelove was not a comedy, it's a historical documentary. And the first thing that happens is, almost word for word, every crazy thing that's said in this movie, such as, "Oh, you know, we might lose 10 million people or get a scratch like that, but we can repopulate the earth by putting two women for every man in underground silos." This was taken word for word from the chief theorist of atomic theory at that time, who showed up at Kubrick's office and demanded royalties. All right. Number two, the hotline that you see the premier of the Soviet Union and the president of the United States talking on didn't exist at the time this movie was being shot and directed. When it came out, we then had something called the Cuban Missile Crisis, and after that, the hotline existed. But the most terrifying thing is that the doomsday machine that ends the movie and ends the world came true. What happened was that the United States nuclear policy for decades and decades, it was called kill a nation, it was called total response, it was called Sunday punch. It had these various names, but it was basically we were going to take our entire atomic arsenal and drop it on Russia and China. And that was our strategy. During the Carter administration, they came up with a new idea that the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China were both such centralized governments that if you killed the government leaders, the countries would fall into chaos. And we wouldn't have to use up all the atomic bombs. We just had to bomb the leaders. And they wrote about why this was called decapitation theory. And they wrote about why this was such a good idea in Foreign Affairs magazine. And the heads of the Kremlin read that Foreign Affairs magazine, and they got a little upset. So they came up with something called perimeter or dead hand, which is in the 1980s version of the doomsday machine. In perimeter or dead hand, a group of surviving Soviet army troops are in an underground cavern in the Urals, and if bombs start dropping on the Soviet Union and missiles start striking and there's no response from Moscow, automatically their missiles and bombs will start flying back. So thanks, decapitation. Now, if you haven't seen, I highly recommend Dr. Strangelove. And I also have to tell you that there's another movie that is equally as important in atomic history, and that is this one. Because the China Syndrome, which includes the line, it could devastate a territory the size of Pennsylvania, was playing in theaters at the same time as Three Mile Island happened. And that coincidence was so powerful that, in fact, the nuclear community could have used Three Mile Island to say that, in fact, no one was contaminated by Three Mile Island, and we did the right thing, and our plants were safe. But because it came out at the same time as this, the reaction in America was completely anti-nuclear, and there was nothing they could do to stop it. And at this point, 20% of our electricity came from nuclear, and today only 20% still comes from nuclear. We haven't added to it at all. And this led to the biggest civil disobedience in American history, which was 1 million people in Central Park protesting nuclear. So that's what happened to us. And then we had something called Chernobyl. Now, there's a funny coincidence in that a couple of months after Three Mile Island, a guy was going into a shipping port, which you know, and he was setting off all the alarms. And they thought he must be being contaminated some way. So they tried to find out how he was being contaminated, and they couldn't find anything. And finally, they went to his house, and he had a radon infestation in his basement. So the human being was contaminating the nuclear reactors. The same thing started happening in Sweden. All of their employees started setting off the alarms, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. And they suddenly realized they were becoming infected from something else, and it was Chernobyl. Now, Chernobyl is a very wild story because, in fact, Chernobyl could not happen anywhere outside the Soviet Union. We have containment shields that would keep this enormous explosion, an atomic fire that raged for 2 weeks and sent a cloud the size of 800 Hiroshimas across all of Europe. But they did not, because they were using the same nuclear reactor to create fissile fuel for warheads to generate electricity for the citizens of Kiev. And in order to do that, they had to move the roof around. So when it blew up, if we haven't had enough irony in this story already, the reason Chernobyl blew up was because they decided to run a safety experiment. And the safety experiment was, if we shut down the reactors, is there enough spin still going in the generators to start back up the reactors? And that did not go well, and a cascade of things happened, and they tried to ramp up the reactors, and they all started blowing up. And people got on the balconies to look at it from the neighboring towns because it was so beautiful. Because when you have a nuclear explosion, it electrifies the air, and it creates this beautiful purple haze. And if you've ever been to Niagara, one of the big waterfalls, that's what it smells like, because the ionization has that fresh, clean smell, just like you have at the waterfall. Now, in Fukushima, who have a terrible story because it survived a horrible earthquake. It survived a tsunami that now we think has killed 18,000 people. And the whole reason it blew up was because they put the batteries in the basement. So that ran out of power. And what to me was a very stark story is that the Fukushima 50, the heroes who saved this from becoming a real ecological disaster, were basically in Japanese society what the men you hire in the parking lot at Home Depot are in our society. They were really considered untouchables already. Many of them were retired gangsters from the Yakuza, and they were sent in to, and they were called gamma sponges. And they had this horror because, you know, Japanese people like to be clean. So someone who's contaminated. So now the people from Fukushima are treated the way the people from Hiroshima or Nagasaki are treated in Japanese society, as being somewhat unclean and contaminated. And maybe you might get something from being near them. Are you thinking of a gift for your grandchildren? I recommend the Atomic Energy Lab. All right. So I called my book The Rise and Fall of Atomic because I really feel we're in the twilight years. I think that, even though all these people get nuclear weapons and say we have them, it's not that many people who have them so far. It's really about 8 people. And, the U.S. and the Soviets spent $35 trillion during the Cold War on nuclear weapons, and the last time we used one was 1945. So I just think the point is getting more and more ridiculous, and we'll still have nuclear weapons, but they'll be so reduced that we won't even think about them. They'll be insignificant. And I think the same thing is happening with nuclear power because every time we have a disaster, it's so mishandled that no one trusts it. And it's gotten to the point where you have to create so many fail-safes to take into so much account anything that could possibly happen that you now have a situation where it's not economically feasible. So there are people trying to work on a technological breakthrough. The Chinese are working on something called pebble bed, which puts the uranium fuel inside graphite so if the thing shuts down, nobody gets blown up. And Bill Gates is supporting something called the traveling water reactor, which they don't tell you enough details about for me to say anything about it. And then there have been a few breakthroughs in fusion research, but I don't know if any of this is going to work out. So that's why I think we're in its declining years. But there is a couple of good pieces of news. The first is that for all of the terrors we've had about nuclear our entire lives, we've been studying the people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And those people have a rate of cancer above the other Japanese of 1%. And none of them have generations of terrible fruit fly mutations that we would expect. And then for Chernobyl, after it sent a cloud of radiation the size of 800 Hiroshimas for 2 weeks across all of Europe to the Pyrenees, the total known deaths from that are 75. 57 are first responders, and the others are children whose families wouldn't leave the territory where the explosion happened, and their children drank the milk of contaminated cows. So all of our fears about this seem to be sort of extreme, but I don't want to leave you with all the sad parts about this. I want to leave you with one slightly happy story, and that is, remember when we were talking about Marie Curie's boyfriend and the cottonwood? Wasn't that a good time? That was a better time, I think, than this. But anyway, you remember I told you how the cottonwoods were called Los Alamos. Well, where I grew up, we also had something named for that cottonwood called the Alamo. And when I was a little boy, I went to visit the Alamo, and I started having these bizarre dreams about it, about how I was helping to rescue the men and women who were there and keep them from dying. But it was all this strange, like, spiritual kind of a dream. And I was a little child, all right, and I couldn't figure out why I was having these weird dreams. And then we went back to the Alamo as an adult and saw the cenotaph, which is the memorial to the dead there. And on it was this very wonderful man rising to heaven. And even though, ladies and gentlemen, I may be no angel, when I bring you the stories of Lisa Meitner and Marie Curie and rescue the dead and bring them back from forgetfulness, I feel that I've achieved that childhood dream, and I thank you for your time and attention.